it's great to be here today. I didn't actually plan. I don't have any prepared talk. Let's put it that way. And though I could come up with something, but what I'd like to do first is just ask you if maybe you have something you'd like me to talk about. If there's anything about the Dharma, Zen, Buddhism, the practice. If you have, yes.
Koans. Yeah. We're studying koans in practice here, and I really liked your introduction to iron.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
So that's my first question.
Okay. Well, koans, okay, at this point, maybe I'll just collect a few things, and then we'll see. Koans, all right. Anything else?
Yeah, why meditation now or never?
Why meditation now or never? Yeah, good question. I didn't answer it in the book, I guess, huh? Anything else?
The problem with other people.
The problem with other people. What about the problem with other people? What is that problem?
Well, for instance, monastics are asked about monastic life, and they say, you know, just greet except for the other monks.
Ah.
And there are people out there who would trigger conditioned reactions in me, and I would like for that not to happen. So in the practice, that diminishes somewhat. But I wish that I could get inside into another person. Rumi says, don't bother with everyone, be everyone. And being everyone, you are no one empty. And I think he was drunk. I have a hitch.
Yeah.
Around the matter, if you could reflect on that.
Yeah. Well, actually, I can see a kind of a convergence here. That's sort of a koan, it would involve meditation, and why now or never? Well, I think, when else? I mean, we're going to deal with this right here, right now. But there's a matter of other people. What was it Rumi said?
Rumi?
Yeah.
Don't bother with everyone.
Yeah.
Don't bother with everybody. Be everybody.
There you go. Okay. Yeah, drunk or not, that's pretty good observation. Of course, the question is, how can we be everyone? But that is really how to deal with other people. You said something about when other people, I don't know, cause some kind of disturbance in me. But of course, if we really look at the situation we're in, we can come to realize that actually there isn't something else out there that's causing some problem in me. That's not where this is coming from. It is in that very seeing of something out there separate and apart from me that, what have we done? We've formed an ego. We've formed a self. We've cut ourselves off from the other. We're seeing the picture in this way, and now we think, well, there's something out there that's disturbing me. But Rumi had it there when he said, become others. And this isn't, it might seem a little difficult when we're really locked into our own ego, but if we look at our situation very carefully, we can see that we're actually not removed from the other. I mean, after all, that other out there disturbing me, and that's, if you look right here, where is this actually taking place? Where is the disturbance taking place? We might even think, well, it's taking place in my mind, and then we'll point to our head, Or maybe, in Japan they might point here, But, this morning in a student talked, he pointed to his butt when he was talking about having a headache. He said when he was a little boy, his mother always liked to tell the story that he said he had a headache, and she said, "Well, where does it hurt?" And he pointed to his butt. But we'll point to specific places, and particularly when it comes to this matter of mind or my mind, and you're disturbing my mind. Well, what is that? What is my mind, and where is it located? If we look very carefully at mental experience, what is taking place just here, just now? How do we locate it? We hear a sound outside the building, or we see something over there. We see a flower over there. Go up, maybe sniff. We can smell the flower. Well, where is this taking place? Where is the seeing? Where is the hearing? Or the smelling? We say, I smell the flower. Well, is it in the flower? But the flower is over there. You seem to be over here. See? But that's our interpretation. I am smelling the flower. It seems perfectly natural to us. And I suppose it is, because the objects of our awareness, our consciousness, they're out there. And I seem to be over here. As soon as the mind works, it functions in this way, and the world is split in this way, and then we're taken by that. But if we look very carefully at the other, whatever it is, the flower or the other person, we can't really locate the actual experience, the hearing and the tasting and the seeing, even the thinking. Where is that taking place? And even if we point to our brain or our heart or anywhere else, we're not locating the actual experience. It is just this. And when we realize that this is the actual immediate direct experience that is happening in this moment, where are we? What are we but just this? And this is just, as Rumi pointed out, this is to become that other. So anyway, I think Rumi kind of had it there. But that's the way to deal with others. It's not dealing with others at all. We don't have to deal with others. It is just becoming very acquainted with this. And to the extent that we can keep ourselves here, we won't have any trouble like that. So that was a bit of a con, but you wanted to hear something. You have a specific question there about koans?
Not really. We're saying the gate was the barrier.
Oh, yeah.
I just read the 24th gate. So we read the first 24th. That doesn't
matter. Yeah. Well, the thing with koans, as I pointed out in that introduction that you mentioned, we think of, we tend to think of koans as, oftentimes people even think of koans as kind of puzzles, something like this, that we need to figure out using the intellect, using our conceptualizing mind. We have a story presented there, and it seems inexplicable. It doesn't make sense. And we think that our job is then to somehow figure this out, work it out like a puzzle. I remember one time, I think I put it in the intro too, that it was Kladagiri Roshi. Actually, it wasn't really dealing with a koan, but we were looking at a piece by Dogen, and then he asked me something about it. And unfortunately, I used the phrase, it seemed rather puzzling, or it was puzzling to me or something like that. His face just kind of shrunk up like it had just bitten into a lemon, and he said, not puzzle. This is not a puzzle. Again, it was just like with your question, it could be like a koan, How do I deal with other people? Well, here's a situation that we encounter all the time in living out a human life. And it can be, kind of puzzling to us. But what the koans are doing, they kind of heighten this area, this place where we can't, intellectually, we cannot grasp this and wrestle it to the ground and figure out what to do. This matter that Rumi had pointed out to us, that to become the other. Well, how do you do it? We will not arrive at that through some kind of intellectual exercise. Through the intellect, through our conceptualizing, through our grasping of the situation, or interpreting our experience in terms of me, myself, here, separate and apart, and removed from the other out there. Now it seems like maybe there's something I can do about it, but there's no resolution to that problem. And this is how we tend to go through life, always locked in to myself, seeing my experience as though it were out there on a wall, projected on a wall, separate and removed and apart from me. And of course, I want to influence those things out there. The funny thing about the mind is you can even take yourself, some image you might have of yourself, and project it out there, and now you're even observing yourself and making observations about yourself. The mind is incredible this way. But we never seem to notice the very fact that we can even do something like that shows that the entire experience that's being experienced here is not concrete. It is not solid. It is not substantial in a materialistic way, or in a way where we can grasp it or take hold of it and control it in some particular way. It is simply a matter of realizing this and realizing that this is the nature of our experience, that we cannot get hold of it. We cannot get hold of a self. We cannot get hold of other. And all of those things that we think, well, what do I do to deal with all of this? Well, that's not our problem. Our problem is to wake up and to see the situation as it is. And how is it? Well, we can't really find ourselves separate and removed from that. And the koan, rather than giving us some kind of puzzle that now intellectually we have to figure out, we have to come up with the answer. I remember way back in my early days, there was a book that came out about, what is it, koans and their answers or something like that. I can't remember. And perhaps somebody had written down what someone said about some koan. Maybe that's how they passed it or whatever. But I guarantee you, there's no set answer for these koans. These koans are there to help us grapple with, to make it exquisitely clear that the situation that we're in is one that we can never grasp and take hold of. And so that is the approach. But koans also, I think, are very liable, like everything else. Dogen said, traps and snares everywhere. Koans can easily become, we can misuse them because we do tend to take hold of things and to work with them in that way as though we've actually gotten hold of something. And so koans have been used, not in the Soto schools so much, or really not at all, mainly because of Dogen's influence, but as, say, a kind of stepping stones, we graduate from one koan to the next and this sort of thing, by arriving at some kind of grasped answer to the koan. Dogen's approach to this was just simply to he would use these as teaching stories to help us to help acquaint us with the immediate experience that is being had. And it has a kind of an ungraspable nature about it, but there is a resolution of the koan that comes with seeing it in this way, and not really by taking hold of any one aspect of it. So those are kind of elements that I was bringing out in that intro. But I would say this: as you then study koans and read koans, don't be too concerned with arriving at some answer, getting some grasp of what it is that the koan is bringing up for us. It is just simply a matter of read the koan, sit with it a while, read it again, and maybe we have a class, a discussion about the koan, people make different observations, and just watch yourself. Never mind if somebody else is grasping, something, taking hold of in a very solid way, interpreting in a very solid way, or they might be attached to that. Never mind that. This is, again, how to deal with other people. Never mind that. You don't need to deal with that. for each one of us. Just stay there and stay with this. And with koans, we just kind of turn them over and turn them over, turn them over, without the idea that somehow I'm going to finally arrive at some grasped answer to the koan. And when we do this, if we continue to do this, really do it, I would say, with all of these teachings, eventually in time, the understanding isn't of a particular nature. It isn't of a grasped nature. It's like in the atmosphere itself. It is just there, and we become tuned into it. That's even poorly phrased, because once again, it's hard to talk about this in a way without, you know, crunching everything down into some solidity here. But Dogen spoke of that as walking in the mist, and this would be part of it. Working with the sutras, working with the koans, just use them in that way. And at some point, you might realize. I remember when I first encountered when the Cleary translations were coming out, though I had been looking at many of these koans, even 10 years earlier. But particularly when the Cleary translations were coming out, and I was, I really wanted to get to know these things. Yeah, that was a Blue Cliff record, and wow, they just seemed absolutely opaque to me, But of course, I was approaching this with the idea of getting hold of something here. But for some reason, I don't know why. Other kinds of teachings like this too. I was somehow fascinated with Nagarjuna when I first started reading his stuff. I couldn't understand that at all, but there was something in it that just kept me there and drew me back to it. And it is in just turning it over and turning it over and turning it over with no intention of ever grasping it. At some point you realize that where before it seemed opaque, now you can actually say something about this koan. And maybe not necessarily about the koan, but the koan itself can engender something deep in your heart and mind that you know quite well and that you can speak out of. And it can help you to just release that. First of all, to find that and then to release that. It is never something coming in from the outside. Whether we're talking about Buddha's teaching or Nagarjuna or Dogen or these koans, it is always the knowledge and the understanding is already with you right now. The enlightenment is already right here. It's just a matter of us finally recognizing what it is that we are already intimately familiar with that we never pay attention to because of our busy minds thinking, grasping. And then this takes us to meditation, and now or never, because this can only be done when we are here, when we are present. We're completely present with this moment and living it out completely. In time, we can realize it isn't me here practicing, and there's a world out there separate and apart from me. We begin to realize the life of all beings is being lived right here, and there's really no distinct thing that can be removed or separated from it. Nevertheless, of course, there is always the appearances, and we should always keep that in mind and not live in some way that defies the way the world appears to be, because this is how the world is. But it is illusory. It is illusory. And so we do not need to take it in a way that we might otherwise take it when we believe that there really is permanence out there, separations, things separate from me, enduring particulars out there, myself also an enduring entity, subject to death, however scary. But we can finally learn through just bringing ourselves back into this moment and learning to recognize that grasping mind when we are taking hold of one thing or another, self or other, whatever. And this is what our meditation is. It's just simply that. It is not to figure something out. It is not to improve ourselves. It is not to find some quiet mind. It is none of these. Don't put anything there. And it is timeless. We can only do this now. It is now or never, because if we aren't making this effort to just be here, be present, then it never it's never going to occur. It can't occur at some other time. There is no other time. There is just this. So this is our meditation, and it is really nothing more than that. I wouldn't make anything more of that. Why meditation? Why now or never? Well, I think I kind of said something about the why now or never. That's the only way it could possibly be. If we're truly in meditation, it is now. there's never any other possibility. But this means at some point the ideas we might have about meditation or its value or why should I do it. Katagiri Roshi used to, in speaking and repeating what other teachers have said, used to point out that, Zazen is useless. And I remember some years ago when I finally realized what he was saying when he said that. And so I said that one time. I remember there was someone here, I won't name who, who came after me. Oh, don't say that. You tell people Zazen is useless and they won't want to do Zazen. But, when we have the idea that Zazen or the meditation is useful, it's going to help me, that's fine. It's not like get rid of that idea. No, I'm not going to tell you to get rid of that idea. But just look at it and bring yourself back to just here. That's all we need to do. At some point, you realize that, when we continue to live out our life in that way, that I will get some benefit from doing Zazen. What is that? Well, that's me. And I'm getting something. There's a greedy mind there. There's grasp things. This is our pain and our suffering and our confusion right there. This is the confused heart and mind. And if we keep carrying that into our practice and or our meditation, and we say that our meditation has to have some great value for me, well, maybe it does. It isn't that it does or it does. But don't bother with that. It's like bothering with other ones again. You don't need to bother with that. If you do, you will continuously perpetuate yourself in this kind of confusion and suffering. So it's a matter of finally starting to understand that and to realize that. And so when you come to your meditation, you're just doing the meditation, and that is all. And it is through the mind that is cultivated in meditation like this that we can finally live without this grasping heart and mind. So I don't know. Maybe did I get all three of you there? Okay. Maybe I'll. Yes.
Could you say something about the use of the word abyss?
Abyss. You want to give me an example of where it's used, or?
In Katagiri's book, he said something about your life. Can be an abyss, or it can be really, really high, or it can be really, really low, an abyss, or top of a mountain, or whatever.
Yeah. Well, there we're speaking of, like an abyss would be, it would be like the very low place. I always think of like the abyssal plane, the abyssal plane, the main floor of the oceans. It's called the abyssal plane. It's about 12,000 feet deep there. Then there's crevices that go way down. But the majority of the ocean's depths are around 12,000 feet, and that's called the abyssal plane. Can you imagine living on the abyssal plane? It'd be dark and cold down there and deep and under enormous pressure. But the abyss, an abyss would be this low place. Yeah. And then you say, well, we can be also on top of the mountain in a high place. But again, as I was saying before, we're really present here. You realize that this is no particular place. It is not high. It is not low. It is not cold. It is not warm. This is really where it is. Nagarjuna called it the peaceful. It is peaceful. And but where is that place? It is right here. It is always with us. It is just simply that we stop insisting or forming it in some way and making it high or making it low or wanting to put myself on some place that is high or feeling, maybe some people even want to be in some low place, but but or feeling yourself, that's more what overtakes us, in the depths of or something like that. If we really learn to look at the situation that we're living out in this moment, we'll realize that we're in no such place. We never are. This is all, you know, kind of psychological factors. This is mental construction. It is our the human mind that sees itself fragmented and wrenched out from the whole, the true mind, true self, totality, you know, all beings, and separate and removed in some way, and now we see. You know, it's like it says in the Xinqing Ming. Just starts right out in the Xinqing Ming. It says, the great way is without difficulty. There is nothing it prefers. You know, that's probably kind of an unusual it's actually closest to the Chinese, I believe. But very often it's translated, the great way is without difficulty for those who have no preferences. Well, I remember kind of locked up into grasping things again. And yeah, I've had no preferences, but then I would prefer not to have preferences, therefore I have it. Yeah, and you know, so it's very easily we stumble into, you know, those kinds of confusion. But then when we put it, and in the Chinese, I believe it does come out this way. It's been a while since I've looked at that, but it's really not stating the self in there. It's just saying that the great way is without difficulty. The great way itself. What is this great way? This is the way of enlightenment. The way of the Buddhas, enlightenment itself, really, reality, dharma, it is without difficulty. So this that we would want to wake up to and to see and to realize and to understand is without difficulty. Why do we seem to have so much struggle then with our practice and with, well, that is our usual mind, that grasping mind. And now we'll see the abyss, or we'll see the mountaintop. And it's not to get to either of these places. It is just simply to wake up right here in this place where the peaceful, as Nagarjuna says, this is the great way, and it is without difficulty. And then it says there is nothing it prefers. That's why it is without difficulty. There's nothing it prefers. Reality doesn't prefer anything. You know, it doesn't prefer a window to a door, or a mountain to an abyss. And all is here. All is present. We can walk into any aspect of this at any time. And if we do it as an individuated self, we're really holding tight to our ego, our self, well, now we're just going to be tossed about in any number of ways. It's very natural for us, of course. But it is possible for us to finally quiet down and to settle down and to realize that these kinds of distinctions and boundaries are not, that this is mental fabrication. And once we realize that, once we can understand that, then we don't need to be caught by this or that. You know, but I think when the abyss, that kind of language is being used, just pointing out, yeah, these extremes, but we need to point to those extremes. And then to finally realize that there's a way out of this. You know, as the Buddha said, there is the unborn, the ungrown, the unconditioned. You know, speaking of this, what we can't grasp. And if were it not for that, then there would be no escape for the born, the grown, and the conditioned. But there is escape for the born, the grown, and the conditioned, because there is the unborn, the ungrown, and the unconditioned. And these are in the very same place. You know, I think, well, here I am. I'm conditional. I'm born. I'm grown. I'm persisting. You know, that's the normal view. But the Buddha points out that right here in this very same place, there is the unborn, the ungrown, the unconditioned, the peaceful, as Nagarjuna says. And how do we ever come to realize that? Well, we don't when we're completely occupied with self and with grasping, constantly getting ourselves entangled in anger or petty jealousies and concerns of various kinds. We just simply need to wake up to that and realize, well, what are we doing? And what is our intention when we come to this practice, when we want to learn this way? Don't we want to finally realize the way that is without difficulty, that itself is without difficulty because it has no preferences? That's why the Xin Qing Ming then goes on to say that picking and choosing, this is the disease of the mind, you know, the dis-ease of the mind. That's where we are. But we do this picking and choosing because, you know, our usual way is to form self. Why does that happen? Why do we form this sense of self? Well, it's because the objects of our consciousness, I should just say the objects of consciousness that informs our consciousness, but the objects of consciousness are compellingly real, substantial for us. So we have to look at them very carefully. We have to look at the other or at the or the smelling, you know, attend to the smelling of the flower or the sound or whatever. And through this, then we can come to realize that there's no separation here. Nothing really to be grasped about it. And yet, here it is. Mm-hmm. Another thing Kadagiri used to talk about, you know, this is reality. Just, here it is. What is it? There we are. It's. But most of us, we're stuck at here it is, and we think, well, here it is. But if you say, well, what is it? Then you'll notice you can't grasp it. Of course, if we're thinking, well, it had to have been here, then we try that, and then, So then we think we're tossed between, well, another duality here, the abyss, the high place, the abyss of being or nothingness. Well, if it isn't something substantial, then it must be nothing. You know, that's where our mind will tend to go. But here it is. What is it? This is the reality. It doesn't rest with either of these extremes. This we can know. This we do know. You actually do know this already. It isn't like enlightenment or awakening to this is something strange or foreign to us, something we have to figure out or get hold of. It's nothing like that at all. That's our confused thinking that thinks in that way. It is just right here. We're already directly experiencing the truth all the time. There's enlightenment right here all the time. You are Buddha. Another, if I were to sum up my teacher's teaching in a single phrase, I think that was it. Kadagiri would say, you are Buddha. And it is just, we already are having this immediate direct experience of truth and reality all the time. What's our problem? Our problem is that we don't return to this place. You know, this silence place, returning to silence. Another one of his books. We don't return to this place. Why? Well, because we're so enticed by the stuff out there. And the stuff out there might not necessarily be other people or the flower or physical things, but even just, you know, objects of our desire or thought, emotions and concepts and things like this. We're just caught over and over again repeatedly. So it's not a matter then that we obliterate these things or we get rid of them. We can't, you know. But that's not how to deal with them, is to either to obliterate them or to grasp them. It is to realize that here it is. What is it? We can't get hold of it. We cannot answer that question. What is it? We don't need to answer that question. We only need to see the true nature of this. So I don't know. Did I get all that from your question? That's what I tend to do, you see. Yes?
I have a basic question. I mean, a lot of what we see in the Buddhist path and stuff is a certain level of accreditation. You know, you go through a series of understandings and takes the shape of classes and that. If I could grasp what you just told me now, today, and just focus on that, what would be the importance of the accreditation beyond that?
I don't know.
Beyond the understanding of what you just expressed.
I'm sorry, what was the last thing you said? Beyond, just before you said beyond? What beyond?
The further you go in the teaching, in studying Buddhism, mm-hmm. It's almost like you get accredited, there's advanced levels. You get something more than what you just told us.
Okay, the Buddha said I teach but two things. There is dukkha, you know dukkha? Pain, suffering, confusion, and release from dukkha. And that's it. The dukkha is when we're living out of the confusion. There's the pain and the suffering. you know, the fear of death, all of this. There's real trauma here, real difficulty. Or you know, there's the wanting, and can I climb this ladder, and can I get this accreditation, and can I, you know, well, look at that. What is that? Just see it directly for what it is. And Buddha said, there's release from this. And that's what he teaches. First, to point this out. To point out human suffering, dukkha. That's the first noble truth. There is such a thing as this. The second, third truth is that it arises. It's not innate. There's a reason for this. And the fact that it arises can be brought to an end. That's the third noble truth. Finally, the fourth is the way to bring about this cessation of dukkha, this kind of suffering and confusion. We can bring it to an end. And that's what this is. If you want to ask, well, then, and then what do I get for that? Well, if I brought it to an end, then would I be certified in some? Well, I don't know. I wouldn't pay too much attention to these certifications and things of that sort. As Dogen, you know, like these graduating from koan, from one koan to another, and that sort of thing. And Dogen, he said this. This isn't really the way to go with this. It's just more grasping, and you know. And of course, then we go through different things. Susan, you know, mentioned, you know, I've had Dharma transmission, all this sort of thing, and now I get so I can wear the brown, and that can look pretty impressive, maybe. To some, but in the end, that doesn't really mean anything. There is this matter: do we understand this or do we not? And that has to do with your own heart and mind, and that's where it takes place. Outwardly, how this will manifest and spin itself out in the world in various ways, I wouldn't try to control that. Just let it be what it is. You know. Sometimes, you know, praises will be heaped on you, or other times condemnation, or there's all that. That's the muddy world out there. I wouldn't be too concerned with that. If your concern is with awakening, then I would say just get to it. As Dogen said, if you want to practice suchness, then practice suchness without delay. So just go right to that. And again, this thing about, well, what am I going to get out of it, or how will I be certified, or how will I know, or could I get to some spot? And then is there something more beyond that? Well, what more do you want than awakening? I mean, you know, and awakening is such that it isn't of a more or a less. It is not something to be grasped at all. It is sitting right where you're sitting right now. It is a matter of just waking up to that. If we awaken to that, then what is your problem? These other kinds of mundane issues, they'll sort themselves out. But if your mind isn't being tossed about, I wouldn't be too concerned with that. In the meantime, I would suggest, well, you do pay attention to how your mind is caught by any number of things, whether it's through ranks and you know. And speaking of something like that, look at Hui Neng, you know, the sixth patriarch of Zen in China, who was a he was an assistant, you know, in the back room of the monastery, pounding rice, and yet he had the greatest understanding, and became a great and influential teacher. That might not have happened. It might not have unfolded in that way. But and no doubt, in many cases, such things happen. There could be, you know, highly. Clear and awakened and, you know, not confused. You know. And another thing, too, is that this awakening, though, it isn't like it's something that belongs to a person. Well, here's a person, a formed person, and then they have this thing, awakening. I mean, yeah, they might have a certificate. They might have a robe. They might have something like that. But this awakening thing is in realizing that there's never any formed thing there in the first place. You know, we can't really get hold of a you or a me, and then this is one of the reasons why these labels and things don't really work so well. But of course, this is human life, and we want to identify certain kinds of things. But all I would say is just keep looking, you know, and don't be confused. That's all you need to do, and. That's enough. We can get through life with that.
If I can, yes. Because that question was kind of connected with what I was thinking.
for me, it's like kind of a burning in my heart. It's not about credentials or about having a status level or anything of that matter, but I'm like looking at my Taekwondo where I started, you know, with no belt and got a black belt. The black belt's not the important thing, but it was working with a master, working with an instructor, and as the 3 years of that it took me to get to that place of him working with me, toning my body, getting my mind straight to the place where it became more free and more flowing than if I actually was at my home with the Taekwondo book of going, okay, this move next and this move next. And I do believe every single person has it in them to do what you're talking about. But I'm also, like, for me, I'm looking for a more formal teaching, like for Thich Nhat Hanh. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about working with his master and mm-hmm. talking about the development of his thought, and then he teaches and so on and so forth. So I don't know if that's a similar question to what you were asking, but, you know, for me, I am looking for more of that formal instruction.
Yeah. Well, no, I think the formal instruction is necessary, actually. You know, and I mean, and as Susan pointed out, I mean, I'm the head of a center, so, you know, we have we certainly have many classes there, and we do this. You know, I wouldn't be offering this or working on this if I didn't think it was important. Because, as I said, like, we need to come together and work with these koans or these different kinds of teachings, and just turning them over, and working then with a teacher, with someone who understands these things and isn't confused by them, and this is very helpful for us. So that's a necessary element. That's part of this whole thing. But in the end, it's that always that grasping thing, and yeah, that's the part I would say. Just never mind about that. Don't worry about that. Or like dealing with other people. Going back to that again, something else out there. You know, how do I deal with it? Well, in the case of other people. Again, nothing to deal with them, and what are you going to do? Straighten them out or order them around? What are you going to do? You know, the way we tend to think of other people, maybe we should drop that. We're worried about what they're thinking, or can I impress them, or, you know, something like that. And yet at the other time about where maybe we could be considerate of them, or thoughtful in some way, or helpful in some way. Generous toward them, we tend not to pay too much attention to that. Again, why is that? Well, because that involves something that you really can't get a hold of quite so easily, whereas, boy, what they said or what they did or this sort of thing, it becomes a more graspable thing. And also it tends to, bring yourself back into the picture a bit. So our way, our practice really, is just simply to start recognizing these things. And then to just move in those directions that are a little bit more healthy, healthy-minded. And this is developing a mind of wholeness and magnanimity, you know, a big mind, and recognizing when that small mind is coming into play. And so even if we get into some kind of a, you know, like a Dharma field, we have a 5-year curriculum there where, you know, people can go through all these, you know, courses. There's no guarantee at the end that you're going to get anything for that. I don't promise that. But if you can approach this in the right way, or just take this up and you just study and you just practice and you just continue to do this. As Dogen said, walking in the mist. That's what you need to do, and that's all. Just continue to do that. And is there anything beyond that? Is there an end to that? No, there's no end to this. Even if we get enlightenment or we get Dharma transmission or something like this, there's no end to that. Because enlightenment is something that, as I said, it's not something belonging to a particular person. It is in recognizing that the particularness can't be found. But in the very next instant, any one of us, even though we finally realize that and understand it and can even say something about that, in the very next minute we can be caught. And suddenly the ego's there. Next thing you know, we're getting angry again or something like this. So it's just endless. So we continue to practice and take this up endlessly. But gradually we can refine this a bit. We just, keep on. But yeah, to bring yourself around to a teacher, to a place, you know, like you have a wonderful place here and a good teacher and you have, you know, things to study. and a wonderful place to practice, and has a nice tradition here. And I would encourage you just to take that up and just to do that, and then just do it, and do it, and do it. Watching your mind the whole time, that's all. Yes?
The self loves to create differences. An example of this is Shikantaza koan practice, Vipassana.
Yeah.
As one gets deeper into one form of practice, one becomes more curious about the other ones. What's the payoff? How do they work? And, of course, you can look at them from the outside, but if you want to know the taste of the water, you have to drink it yourself. Koans can be looked at in 10,000 times, 10,000 different ways. One way they can be looked at is as a tool for the teacher. When you go into Doksan with your teacher, if you're in koan practice, at some point, the teacher will ask you about the koan. It's a way for the teacher to know where you are. It's a hot potato. He's passing it to you. Catch.
Yeah, of course, there's always something. Teacher's watching. There's always something going on there. But, you know, here's another thing about a teacher watching you. You should understand. If you really have a true teacher watching you, you don't need to worry about what the teacher is. Sometimes you're in the presence of the teacher, will start to act in a different way. You don't need to do that. You want the teacher to know you. So just show yourself as you are to the teacher. The teacher probably already knows quite a bit anyway. But the thing you have to understand is that the teacher can see you because the teacher is not judging you. That has to be understood. Somebody who is judging you, and possibly the teacher could lapse a bit and then form a judgment, but if they really understand this, they'll let that one go. They're just with you in that moment, and that allows you to change. You know, they don't have you pegged. Well, this is a stupid person, or this is a great, you know, whatever. Just leaving it all very fluid. They're not judging. So you should just realize that anyone who can really see you isn't judging you, and somebody who's judging you, they don't see you because they have frozen something out, and you are not something frozen. Nothing is, and so that's an important thing to understand. So you don't need to, the last person you need to be afraid of in terms of showing yourself or revealing yourself, you know, and how you are, your you know, stinky personality or whatever, the last person you need to be afraid of is the teacher. You don't need to impress the teacher. So I just wanted to make that point. That's hard to understand, you know, because like with Kage Roshi, you come around him, you know, and you want to be on your best behavior and that sort of thing. Eventually you have to realize that he's not judging you, she's not judging you, if you have a true teacher there. So don't worry about that. And now you can relax then in the presence of the teacher. I say relax, I don't mean to become sloppy or something like that, but just don't allow that to interfere with your mind. Because that will impede the teacher being able to help you or see you, you know, to point something out for you. So I don't know if that helps or not. Are we getting to end it? I see another hand here. Yeah.
I just had a question. Since it all just is, right? What is all the practice and meditation and teaching and learning if there's no goal to reach?
Yeah. Well, there isn't any point. There isn't any point. And there's the freedom. Yeah. And you say, if it all just is, well, that's the whole thing. We can't say that it all is. We can't say is, but you have to understand we can't say is not. Now there's your here it is and what is it? Oh, it is. Well, I'd say, well, here it is. Yes, it is. But what is it? You know, can't get hold of it. So is it? Well, we can't say it is. Well, is it not then? Well, here it is. So we can't get hold of that. What is the goal? Well, the goal is all we need to do is just to realize that and to understand how that's playing out in every little aspect of our life, to just become more and more acquainted with that, which is really more a matter of really becoming acquainted with your own mind and seeing how your own mind is being captured by one thing or another. So that's all this is. And then to say, well, then what's the point of the goal? You have to see that you striving for that goal, you have to get there, you have to get that certificate or that whatever. That's the dukkha. See, that's why I was saying that the Buddha pointed out there's dukkha and release from this. I want the release. Well, look at what you're doing. You can't have release if you want that release. That's my goal. You know? You have to understand, you can't grasp this. See, but that what we have to do is finally understand what that means, that grasping mind and how it's operating. And, of course, I want to get that. Just recognize what that is. You see? You understand? See, and I can't hand you anything here. I can't tell you this is what it is. But there's freedom in this. We can only kind of point in this general way, because every time it becomes, well, one Zen master said something about, a teacher, maybe a false teacher, a confused teacher, hands you a chain. They hand you something. They just hand you something. And you take it. Oh, thank you. And then you just strap on the chain, and then, oh, here's another one. Oh, okay, we just, And that's our ordinary way. But this is something different. It is subtly different. Well, how is it subtly? Well, that's what I've been trying to point to this morning a bit. But you can't really get your hands on this. But we don't need to. We only need to wake up to our confusion. That's all. And once we understand our confusion, that's it. Of course, in the next moment, you can lapse back into confusion. So be careful. We have to continue this practice. That's all. I had the impression, is it getting late? I'm willing to sit here. It is time. Okay. All right.